Welcome to the Johan René podcast, where we dabble in philosophy, sample a little culture, perform some politics, grapple with history, and make the dip into religion. With me, your gezonde Dutch host, Johan René Schaper. Okay, everyone, welcome to the Johan René podcast. I'm your host, Johan René. Blah, blah, blah. We all know the thing. Today, I'm going to talk about a very interesting topic, namely, I'm going to talk about arguments for the existence of God. And with me is the great Dr. Tyrone Goldsmith. Tyrone Goldsmith, what is it? Tyrone Goldsmith or Schmidt?
That'll do.
Yeah, that's fine. Dr. Tyrone Goldsmith, he has published several books on philosophy and on religion, philosophy of religion and on ethics. And he is soon going to publish a book on the ontological argument and a book on David Hume, which are two very different things. I think David Hume has an argument against the ontological argument, doesn't he?
David Hume has a famous objection against the ontological argument, yes. The ontological argument is one of the more famous attempted proofs of the existence of God, right, from the Middle Ages, and it still has some interest today. And David Hume, on the other hand, is one of the history of philosophy's greatest skeptics, right? And he has an excellent skeptical treatment on many religious topics and a famous rejection of the ontological argument. That's right. These are very different, very different directions.
I'm going to nerd out immediately. Would you consider David Hume a philosopher of religion? Because I do, kind of, like, because natural religion, he does talk about it. He doesn't believe in it.
I think that he's one of the greatest philosophers and one of the greatest philosophers of religion. Yes, I wouldn't hesitate to describe him as a philosopher of religion. His dialogues concerning natural religion, which is an ingenious attack on various attempts to prove the existence of God. Whether David Hume's attacks work is another question, but his dialogues concerning natural religion is a classic, one of the greatest books written in philosophy of religion.
Oh, okay.
He's not a philosopher of religion. I don't know who is.
Well, there you go. Yeah, some people like to toss around. Oh, he's like a. They put him in different categories. I don't know, ethics and. Like, if there's a philosophy of atheism, like, that's like a separate.
Well, David Hume contributed to various areas of philosophy. He worked on the big questions of ethics. He wrote on the big questions of religion, too. He wrote on big questions about knowledge. There's hardly a big question in philosophy, right? From morality to free will to skepticism to God that he didn't write on. Though, since you mentioned the term atheist, maybe I should caution there. I'm not sure that David Hume is an atheist.
I was going to ask him.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe he might be too skeptical to have a very confident position, atheistic position, just as much as he's too skeptical to have a confident religious position. I don't think he's an atheist. Maybe he's a kind of like 18th century deist or something like this.
Right. The categories don't apply the same way back then.
Yeah. I don't think he believes that the classical conception of God is true. Right. But I don't know if he believes that there is no God.
Right.
He's a pretty skeptical character.
Okay, but we're going to talk about arguments for God now, and specifically in Judaism, because you, of course, are a traditional Jew, right? You are an Orthodox Jew, and you are a philosopher. And when you read, like, the Jewish texts, like from the 50s and 60s and 70s, from texts, they say, oh, there's no more arguments for God. They're all being refuted by Kant. And that is like three lines. Berkovich throws in like four lines, and then they move on, right? But since that time period, we can't always quote Soloveitchik anymore from the 60s. Since that time period, whether or not we hold these arguments to be good, there has been a revival, right? We had Alvin Plantinga starting in the late 60s, start publishing about the arguments for God. And of course, Bill Craik, Lim Ling Craik published his book on reviving the Kalam cosmological argument for the existence of God, force, cause. And then downwards, of upwards, but several books have been published in the 80s and then in the 90s, and even today, including yourself, published on the topic. So could you tell me a little bit about just the state of God in the philosophy departments today, which some people seem to exaggerate and some people seem to downplay?
The question of whether there is a God, whether we can prove that God exists or prove that God doesn't exist, what the nature of God is, and so on, these deep religious questions have been perennial in philosophy. People become a little less religious, you know, following the Enlightenment, and maybe these questions receive a little less attention. And there were certainly many philosophy departments became very skeptical about the traditional, philosophers generally became very skeptical about the traditional proofs of the existence of God, especially under the influence of the criticisms of David Hume, who I mentioned, and Immanuel Kant, who you mentioned. More generally, maybe, philosophy departments, philosophers became more skeptical of, I don't know if that's the right word, they had a certain view about how much progress we could make on fundamental metaphysical questions, not only God, questions about free will and so on. Right. Atheism became fashionable among philosophers in the generally, I think there was a time where philosophers were less interested in or held less, you know, they took less seriously traditional debates about metaphysical, you know, questions about God and free will and such like questions. But the objections of Hume and Kant and other objections that became, that led to the demise for a time of philosophy of religion and the, you know, reduce the interest in philosophers worrying about and debating whether God exists, whether we can show that God exists, or the opposite. These objections against the existence of God or our prospects of coming to an answer on this question or so much, even the very meaningfulness of the question, these objections have answers. There are lots of answers to Hume and Kant. Of course, there are replies to those answers in turn and subsequent replies. That's the nature of philosophy. But yes, starting in the 1960s, certainly the 1970s, there was a revival, the beginning of a revival, of interest into serious philosophical discussion about the existence and nature of God. The old objections of Hume and Kant were the subject a lot of that discussion. Many philosophers didn't think those objections against proofs of the existence of God, the existence of God itself, or a doing philosophy of religion, or any of this. Many philosophers didn't think that those famous objections of Hume and Kant were powerful. Meanwhile, even while they were answering certain objections from Hume and Kant, these philosophers were developing in their own ways new proofs or attempted proofs, right, of the existence of God. New proofs or attempted proofs of the non-existence of God too, right? There was a lot of more work done on these big religious questions suddenly among philosophers of religion. It wasn't only showing that the old criticisms of Hume and Kant are questionable, but it was also developing new ideas or updating old ideas, even medieval ideas.
Refurbishing. Right? William Lane Craig uses the word refurbishing.
So you might have Plato, Aristotle presenting a kind of argument for the existence of God. Or maybe it's Maimonides and Aquinas who present, but they present it in their own way, given their own scientific understanding of the world. And a lot has changed since. So these contemporary philosophers updated, refurbished these arguments in more modern terms with a more contemporary understanding of how the universe works. But they're in the same spirit. And the figures you mention, Alvin Plantinga, for example, was indeed a major contributor to the revival of philosophy of religion. Perhaps the most important philosopher who writes on arguments for and against the existence of God, who writes on these alleged proofs, to use the word loosely, proofs of the existence of God, is Richard Swinburne.
Right.
Both of these are Christian. Both of them are Christian philosophers, and most participants in this contemporary philosophical debate about the existence and nature of God, or the non-existence of God, or religious belief, you know, religion and science in general, most of the contributors are Christians and atheists. But right. there are many, many Jewish philosophers, and there are some Jewish contributors to contemporary philosophy of religion too.
Right, you're one of them.
I write on these big questions too, and I'm one of them.
We're gonna place you in the same line. There, we're going to do it.
There. I should make a distinction. Distinguish between the kind of work that I do, and the kind of work that the people that I'm talking about do, Jewish and non-Jewish, from what sometimes goes under the heading of Jewish philosopher or Jewish philosophy. And maybe your listeners are more familiar with the idea of Jewish philosophy as it's taught in, you know, religious studies or Jewish studies departments, as it's taught by most people working under the heading of Jewish philosophy. Jewish philosophy for them means a lot of intellectual history.
Right, they're historians of philosophy.
Right, right. What did Maimonides say? What exactly did he mean? What did he eat for breakfast? What color was the ink he used? How was he influenced by Muslim philosophy? How did he influence Christian philosophy? And this is very, very, you know, some of this is done very painstakingly and excellently. But it's not the kind of work that I have in mind and that my colleagues and friends and philosophers have in mind when we speak about philosophy of religion. Now, we're interested in whether Maimonides' alleged proof of the existence of God works. Okay.
Right.
What are his steps? How does his, what are his premises, his axioms? How do those support the conclusion? Do they support the conclusion? Does Sa'adia's, you know, proof of the existence of God work? Is he right? Are they right when they talk about the divine attributes and religious language and faith and reason? What criticisms might there be against their views? How can these be answered? We're interested in the truth of the matter, not just the history. Now, that might be presumptuous, but it's what we do. It's what we do, it's a little different from what what goes under the heading of philosophy, of Jewish philosophy, most of the time. I think it's more interesting. I think it's more interesting to ask the question of, does God exist? How can we know that God, maybe there's evidence against the existence of, how of science and religion? I think these are more interesting questions, and more interesting questions to the proverbial man in the street too, right? I think that average Jewish believer, you know.
No such thing as average Jews.
Somebody who doesn't, you know, somebody who doesn't have a philosophical background or much care for these abstract questions would still feel the pull and find these interesting. They'd make for a good dinner table conversation. I think that it would interest them more than what usually goes under the heading of Jewish philosophy. But alas, there's very little of what I do and what my friends do. Very few religious Jews who are participating in this discussion. Hopefully there'll be more.
I find myself often to be one of the few laymen who's just excited about this stuff. I love this stuff. I like bad arguments, good arguments. I like the puzzle. I like to figure it out. I like to see, I like to meet the opponents. I get into it. You know, it's like a fight back and forth. Then they go into the weird weird formulations of like abstract numbers and it becomes all the codes. Then I skip that page. That skip page is skip.
It is.
It's probability theory, I'm done. I'm moving on. But the rest I love.
I suppose there's a certain feel to philosophical debates that religious Jews might seize in a way, you know, in rabbinic debates in the Talmud and so the to and fro, objections and replies. He has a line of reasoning, he has some objections, he has some replies. Let's get to the heart of the matter. Who wins? And that's, you know, it can be great fun.
Oh, I love it. I love it. But then when I meet people, like, you know, people are interested, but like often they have Emuna questions and I don't feel like I can answer Emuna questions with fun arguments that are really too complex for them to follow. And they don't really care that much to go that deep. They just want to know it's okay. So, but beyond that, yeah. I haven't seen much engagement on the lay
part. It's a philosophical question in itself. Does a religious believer need to have a proof of their religious views? Can a religious believer in good conscience, can a religious believer rationally continue to believe what they do on the basis of, you know, faith or something like that, rather than religious arguments and proofs and philosophy? That is itself a question in philosophy of religion, right?
And in Judaism.
Right. Yes, right. Many of the great medieval Jewish philosophers thought it was very important for religious believers to understand, not only to know that God exists or believe in the existence or believe certain Jewish principles, but to really understand them and see their basis in reason. But of course, that is controversial. Others don't take that view.
Right. Sadia Gaon held that the regular person, God revealed religion to it, but theoretically, you could found the truth of Judaism to reason alone, which then he doesn't go and argue so much for, but that's a claim he makes.
Yeah, whether we should, whether we have to, whether right. Religious, you know, religious obligation or, you know, something good to do.
Right.
to try to pursue these proofs and is a question that they might have disagreed about. Some might have thought it was a good idea to do this sort of stuff, some not. And maybe different strokes for different folks, as they say. Maybe this kind of philosophical approach to religious ideas can benefit some people religiously, maybe others not. I mean, maybe some people are really harmed or misled, or, you know, it causes them some distress or something like this to think too hard about these philosophical puzzles. There are different people, probably.
Right. Yeah, I get the impression from the Torah that like religious arguments are not pushed because like they experience God through the prophets and through the, it's like God is like a person, Lahavdil, right? Chilling out among the Am Yisrael and like he's telling them things, right? So there's not much of a philosophical reasoning going on.
It's just an encounter. You might find in the Torah something of an argument for the something of a case for the existence of God. I think it tries to do something. We might speak about this maybe another time. But I think that it tries to make a case on the basis of tradition for its historicity. That this is in the text, of course, many people would find controversial. It seems to me a person can be perfectly rational, reasonable, entitled to accept their religious tradition on the basis of testimony, on the basis of the tradition, you know, the testimony of that tradition handed down to them by community, on the basis of participating in the community, on the basis of the fact that maybe that tradition makes them happy or makes them a better person. I'm not the sort of person who thinks that one has to have any sort of proofs or has to engage too deeply in philosophy to be a rational Jew, to be to be entitled to some people think that in order to have religious views and to rationally, so you have to be able to have some sort of proof in your pocket, right? There's a lot of popular public debate between religious believers and atheists, and they're always asking for this. I don't think that the religious believer needs to have any sort of proof in their pocket. I think what religion does for their lives, I think all these things can play an important role that makes their faith reasonable for them, rational, and so on. I just find it fun and enlightening to engage in these philosophical puzzles and questions about the existence of God myself.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, also I feel that a lot of people, like when it comes to God, their skepticism dial goes really up high. And then when it comes to any other question, like human rights, evidence for morality, evidence for the free will, for their own materialism or these entire political views, all these worldviews that hold these complex things that itself need rigorous argumentation, if you want to go, could, right? But they don't apply that same standard to almost any of the other beliefs.
Yes, some people in popular and public debate about religion are always thinking that one's religious views must be based on a kind of very watertight and rigorous philosophical proof that doesn't face any objections, can answer them all. Whereas they freely tout moral views that they themselves don't support, with anything like watertight philosophical. Why I think there is any such thing as morality. Why I think there is any such thing as free will. Why I think all these things. One seldom hears in these critics, and their very high bar they set for religion. One seldom hears them raise the same questions for other things. One seldom sees them raise such a high bar for other big philosophical questions. Of course, it sometimes goes the other way around. Sometimes people are very credulous and just accept religious teachings and religious ideas, no matter how silly or strange they are, without any critical thinking or engagement. People are funny.
Right. Well, I think in general, in the West at least, we have a tradition where, in philosophy, where religion is debated in the public, because also religion held, of course, a very strong, powerful grip on society. There was a political debate, there was a fight. So these are things that in our culture is transmitted, this fight about religion in evidence and arguments, but they don't, the fight about whether human rights are objectively demonstrable, which of those rights have strong evidence for it, which against, right? Those questions they don't ask, because we don't have a history of fighting over that. So we don't have a collective memory, so to speak, in the culture. Well, on religion, we do. So somehow on religion, we get, much more critical because our culture is historically trained to be more critical about it because of that political fight.
Maybe that's an interest. That's a curious historical kind of explanation or observation. People have been fighting over religions for a long time. Maybe this sets up, maybe this results in, when it comes to popular and public debates about religion, different standards. To be sure, though, people have been fighting about political ideas and moral ideas too.
This is true.
Maybe I don't know how to compare how many people have suffered and died from religious disagreements over how many people have suffered and died over other kinds of political disagreements.
Right.
Pretty grim on both sides.
Right. That's for sure true. I wanna shift gears. I wanna talk about some specific. Let's talk about the Jewish and analytic philosophers of religion, because that's what you guys are, analytic philosophers of religion. You analyze religion and then a critical mind, rather than continental philosophy, which of course I'm European continental, I'm not British, so, so we have continental philosophy, and you know, where you just dream about large pictures and then write poetry about it.
Yeah, in a
critical way.
This is broad brushstrokes. Philosophers on continental Europe, especially in France and Germany and so on, are interested in grand narratives, right?
Right.
And in portraying very deep and striking portraits of the human condition. And also, some of the literature is characterized by kind of over-sophistication in a way. You know, it's very pretentious, a lot of the writing, to be frank. Seems often to be gibberish to the average reader, there is this. I guess the way I see philosophy done outside of the continent, analytic philosophy, philosophy as it's done in maybe English-speaking countries more, England, USA, Australia, is. A little less ambitious in a sense. I mean, it's not about grand narrative so much, though there are some people in that tradition who do that. But what I like to look at are little arguments and little puzzles. Here's an alleged proof that God exists, or that we have free will, or that morality is real, or that it isn't. None of these things exist. Let's consider objections. Let's consider replies. Let's do it as ploddingly, clearly, and carefully as possible. I think there's more, that's the kind of philosophy and stuff that I'm interested in. I think there's more of that done in the so-called analytic tradition in English-speaking countries than in the continental tradition. And I think that's that project, thinking clearly, scientifically, carefully about these deep questions, is continuous with what philosophy has been historically. I think David Hume, were to resurrect today, he'd be working in the analytic, so-called analytic tradition. I think the same for Aquinas and Maimonides and Socrates and Aristotle and so on. You know, I think they're interested in the same questions, in getting at them in the same way. But we shouldn't perhaps paint too broad brushstrokes. You know, there are philosophers working in Europe who are interested in these questions and pursuing the same style, and there are of course many philosophers in the English-speaking world who pursue so-called continental philosophy. The boundaries are blurred, and of course people would object to even marking out such boundaries.
Right, that itself is a philosophical debate of language.
I like these questions. Do we have free will? What is it? Does God exist? What is God's nature? Can we prove any of these things? What is morality? Okay, how do I know, you know, what are numbers? You know, do they really exist, such weird things as numbers? These questions interest and puzzle me, and I just like to see little arguments about them, so-called proofs of the existence of God or against the existence of God, or free will. You know, I don't know why I keep on mentioning these two. There are many deep questions and debates about them. That's what I'm interested in doing, and I'm interested in looking at it in clear, simple.
Right. Well, one of the big differences, I also really enjoy analytic philosophy. I also like continental philosophy. It's just less rigorous in my mind. Like it's nice and it's interesting. It's less rigorous. Like when I read analytic philosophy text, it will spend several pages or more explaining, like, when I say justified, I mean the following six things. I do not mean the following, right? They clarify the word, and then they use it. And in continental philosophy, it's like, I'm not going to use the word justify. I'm going to use, like, imperia, verificatia, like this romantic word, homo religiosus.
There can be a little overkill.
We get, like, these complex words, especially in critical theory, which is mostly American, really. Critical theory in modern, postmodern theory. It's just, like, poetry almost, complex words for simple things. When and analytic philosophy is like whole pages to explain a simple word. Sometimes it's more clear.
That's a little much. I don't know if all those pages are needed to explain a simple word.
Well, you like Swinburne, he does that now.
um, But yeah, this is the kind of what you're describing as analytic philosophy is the kind of philosophy I'm interested in, and the kind of thinking that I like to bring to bear on Jewish topics, and that a few other philosophers around today like to bring to bear on Jewish topics, though not many, not many. Most people working in quote unquote Jewish philosophy are working on a kind of intellectual history or continental theology and so on.
It's a little bit changing. I just saw that Sam Liebens, who's a philosopher of Judaism, analytic philosopher of Judaism in Haifa, I think, University of Haifa, am I correct?
Yes.
He just put out a book, and it's trending number one Jewish books. So, and it's analytic philosophy.
It's an excellent book. Let's take the chance to recommend his book, The Principles of Judaism. That's the title to your audience.
By Sam Liebens. Well, he taught me he would come on. So
we'll work with quite a lot. And there are a handful of us who work together on these questions.
Right. Sam, I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and George Schlesinger.
Oh, wow.
He was living there. Listen to this. And he passed away right when I got into George Schlesinger. And I'm like, wait, Schlesinger, doesn't he go to Baron Hirsch? No, that's his son. I'm like, really? Yeah, but he passed away. I'm like, are you kidding me? It was like he was already already old and stuff. Yeah. He was in the old age home right there when I lived in Memphis. And he passed away the same year that I got into him.
I never had met George Schlesinger, though he was a philosopher at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where I spent a couple of years, you know, as a student and visiting scholar or whatnot. But I just missed him. He'd left. I missed him too. He'd left right there. And that, he certainly was working in a philosophical environment where there were far fewer than even there are today people writing on Jewish philosophy.
Oh, yeah, I read his stuff. Most stuff is from the 70s, 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote
stuff in philosophy of religion. He wrote on, I think, space and time and probability theory and various topics in philosophy. But he wrote some philosophy of religion in the 1980s that is, you know, is pretty impressive. It was the start of people seriously engaging in these questions. And he seems... Yes. Anticipate some moves. I believe he was a from Jew, and if I stand to be corrected, he was a rabbi, and he went in Israel. I'm trying to think where did he know the
Yerushalayim. I know.
I think he speaks about meeting or knowing
Chazanish.
Chazanish, yeah. Did he know?
He started with him. I mean, he met him. He met him. He was studying with a different Rav, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I just remember. I remember something very orthodox about
the
biography of his, or in something he wrote. Some.
Well, I hope to get his son on at some point.
Oh,
talk about it. But his son is not a philosopher. He didn't raise his kids to be philosophers.
Does he have a son who's an archaeologist or something?
No, his son is a businessman. He has one son, one child, and his son is.
Sorry. I must be mixing up something. Sorry, it's way off base.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll hopefully get him on. And he wasn't raised philosophically. He was raised with Judaism, though. Judaism meant a lot more to him than, like, the puzzles we find funny, I guess. Okay, arguments for God. Let's go over this. Now, you know, there's many arguments for God that are popular. Like, the design argument got a big boost lately the last 30 years, from the initial condition of the Big Bang, or it's called fine-tuning, right? Like, this whole argument around fine-tuning, a cosmological argument trying to derive the... design, the first cause argument came back, right, with the Kalam cosmological argument, right, which argued that it's as the first cause to the universe, then that cause must be a transcendent cause, which is God, and a lot of work on that. I think that one has a lot of critics and defenders on all that. It's just a popular argument.
Yeah. These are very traditional attempted proofs of the existence of God, and we use the word proof in a more or less loose sense. I mean, some people think that these very powerful arguments. If you read the premises and don't accept the conclusion, you got to die. Or
something. Right.
There's no way a rational person could fail to be certain that God exists once they they read these arguments, but we might use the word proof in a looser sense, you know, like a line of some evidence.
Evidence, an argument. You know, I always say to people, within the realm of reason, when you talk about these topics, they're good, reasonable approaches.
Philosophers are more confident and some less confident. Some think they decisively show that God exists. Some that they provide pretty good evidence or little evidence for a cumulative case for the existence of God. But these arguments that you mention are very traditional. The cosmological argument, actually, there are a lot of versions.
Three of them. Three of the popular ones today.
Hundreds
of them, probably.
Yeah, hundreds of versions of each of these versions, right?
But you have the Leibnizian, you have the Kalam, and then you got the Aquinas guys from them.
What's common about these arguments is that they start from a very simple observation about the universe, a very, very basic general fact of the universe. The universe exists, right? It's there. And the arguments conclude that because it's there, there must be something that brought it about. Well, that's one way of presenting the, you know, that's one kind of a very cartoonish, rough, simplified way of thinking of one kind of cosmological argument. Okay. The universe exists. You have some sort of principle that things that are like the universe have to have causes, supernatural causes. So you conclude that there must be a supernatural cause for the universe. Okay.
I love that argument, by the way. I love the Leibnizian. The Kalam, I have like a whole thing about temporal becoming. I'm not going to get into that. But
I guess the Leibnizian cosmological argument captures, it's a kind of argument for the existence of God that captures the big question, why is there something rather than nothing, right? Why is there a universe like it? This universe looks, to use a philosophical term, contingent. It looks like the kind of thing that needn't have existed. There could have been a different universe in its place, or no universe at all. Maybe there could have been a blank. So the question is, why? Why is there this stuff? And one answer, and the answer that the argument, you know, advocates, is that there must be something that brought about the stuff, and something that has a stronger grip on reality, something that couldn't have failed to exist, which, you know, a necessary being that could not have failed to exist. Which must be impressive in other ways to have brought about a universe like ours, something that starts to look like God. That's a very rough, loose kind of presentation of what, you know, the kind of thinking that the cosmological argument captures, or one version of the cosmological argument captures. And then you mentioned the Zahn arguments. There are also many versions of this, and these attempts to prove, in a loose sense, the existence of God. These attempts to prove the existence of God take not such a general observation about the universe, you know, that it exists, say, as its starting point. These arguments take a more particular evidence, take more particular observations about the universe as the starting point. The universe is really beautiful, or pretty, or intricate, or complex, or there's something about it, or the parts of it, that look designed, right? They look like the kinds of things that would need to be made by an intelligent being. Early on, especially in the 18th century, defenders of this argument, proponents of this argument, would focus on biological organisms and their parts. Look at the human eye, animal eye. Look at our bodies. Look how just perfectly adapted they are to an environment. This couldn't have come about by chance, right? There's no way something so beautiful, intricate, complex could have come about by chance. This must have been the product of intelligence, of divine design. That kind of argument line of reasoning was popular in the 90s.
Before evolution.
Yes, right. So the option seemed to people at that time to be two, right? Either these things are the product of some sort of our bodies and organisms and their parts, or the products of an intelligent designer like God.
Right.
Or they were the result of random chance, right?
Right.
You never find something so intricate that's the result of Lorenzo. You come across, as an example, a clock or a watch on a heath. Right. You come across some sort of machine on the beach. You immediately see this is too complex to have, you know, come about by the winds and the waves randomly. There must have been some artisan. There must have been a watchmaker that created this, and they concluded, right. Between the options of the design and randomness, design is the way to go. But along comes Darwin and proposes a third way. Right? There might be a way that you can get complex, intricate organisms on the scene without at least direct divine design and without perfect randomness either. And that's through that's sort of random genetic mutation and natural selection and the evolutionary story. So the theory
something
of,
like chance.
Something like chance, but not in,
it's not, I don't talk to a philosopher, so I phrased it carefully.
Waves that, you know, smashed against some particles and produced a human or an animal body. No. There's random genetic mutation that is chancy. But natural selection isn't so chancy. And these things could produce organisms, no God needed, or so the story goes. And this Darwin's work, the theory of evolution, dealt a very heavy blow to design arguments. A very heavy blow. And I don't know if these kinds of design arguments that focus on organisms and their parts have recovered. Every once in a while you hear of somebody or read of someone who thinks that there's a problem with the theory of evolution or something.
Yeah, I'll go by probability theory.
The majority of this kind of design argument has fallen out of favor, but other design arguments have taken its place, right? These days, philosophers who argue for the existence of God from design in nature focus on more fundamental appearances of design. There are laws of nature, right?
Right.
Why does our universe behave in a law-like way at all? For evolution to work, you need natural laws, laws of physics. Why? Why is our universe regular? And not only the fact that the universe is governed by laws, but the fact that these laws seem to be tweaked in a way. Scientists supposedly have discovered that if laws were slightly different, life like ours couldn't have emerged. And this alleged fine-tuning of the laws of nature also is taken by many contemporary religious philosophers to be evidence for the existence of God. And these cosmological arguments, modern versions of them, and design arguments, modern versions of them, are the subject of much debate.
Right. Now, with the cosmological argument, for the design argument, really, obviously people that in the scientific realm also use some of these probability theories, and then they conclude the multiverse because of the unlikeliness of this universe being like this. So this reasoning does exist outside of the philosophy department, but mostly discussed within the context of philosophy of religion.
Right. Here science becomes very relevant, right? We've got to be on top of the scientific facts to properly formulate the argument, to properly assess the argument. It becomes difficult, tricky.
It's a whole field. It's like ridiculous.
You could spend an hour carefully presenting the simplest design argument, and then a whole day just touching on some of these harder ones and the scientific facts that are relevant and objections and replies that we'd need to get entangled in.
Right, because if you argue from scientific evidence, you have to delve into the science, and there itself, there's many debates, right? This is not a settled debate itself in science, many of these questions, right? There's different models, different hypotheses, different things are popular in different years. Like, it's a whole new world. And I spend hours and hours and hours just reading the science. It is a lot of work just to get a little argument about God going.
It's daunting stuff, but I hope that maybe your listeners can get some feel, some idea of what philosophers of religion in particular are up to here from a very terse and brief summary.
Yeah, let's go. I asked you if there's any particular argument you would be interested in exploring with me on the podcast just shortly, and we settled on the argument from religious experience. Now, there's a lot to say about that, but what is the argument for religious experience?
Somebody had recently, I don't know if I'm a go-to person for YouTube to talk about proofs of the existence of God. I do other philosophical topics, right? I write on other things, but nobody ever wants to interview me on them.
I will. I just thought this was like a fun topic for me because I like this stuff.
I'd already spoken about some other proofs of the existence of God in other YouTube interviews. So I thought, well, there's a different one that I haven't spoken about yet. I haven't really thought much about it, but I found it intriguing, and it might be fun just to chat about the so-called argument from religious experience for the existence of God.
So let's go through it. Could you give a small presentation what this argument is and what it tries to prove?
It tries to prove, in a loose sense, you know, maybe not definitively, it tries to give evidence for the existence that God exists, for the existence of God. And it's quite a bit less abstract than the cosmological and design arguments that that we mentioned, that we introduced briefly. Right? Doesn't depend on such complicated philosophical or scientific ideas. So maybe it's one that your listeners can appreciate easily enough without any scientific background. It's pretty simple, I think. Basic idea is that religious experiences that seem to the subject, at least, who are having them, to be experiences of God, of God's presence, right? Or of God's doing something, God's forgiving them, right? Or some other sort of maybe mystical experience, right? Of something relevantly supernatural, that these religious experiences provide evidence for these objects existing, for God forgiving you, and so on, that we should take them at face value in a way, right? That is the heart of the argument from religious experience. There are these religious experiences. People seem to see God, or perceive God, or God's doing something to or with them, or something else quite supernatural involving God. People have these more or less mystical experiences. Therefore, probably, God exists. God is present, forgiving them, doing whatever it is doing. He's doing. Now, that's the starting points and the conclusion. But of course, you need a little bit of moves to get from that starting point to the conclusion. It's not quite as simple as that.
Right. Let me formulate the argument. So you're saying because some people or many people have religious experiences, that itself is a case that there is a God? Or are you saying for the individual, if you have a religious experience, that is for the individual?
There are different ways we could phrase this. It's reasonable for the individual who has the experience to believe that that experience is of something real. Okay. That's a genuine experience of God. It is what it seems to be. And some will take it further. Not only is it reasonable for that individual to trust his experience, but we should too. The rest of us who don't have it should trust that experience based on that individual's witness or testimony, what they report. I might present it more fully before it's, you know, the listener gives up on this entirely as foolish and silly. Okay. I certainly did think that this was a silly and foolish argument. I thought this was a very bad argument for the existence of God. You've got these people, you see these people in the video, you know, they're having these religious experiences, waving their hands into the area. Here comes some sort of minister, touches them, and they faint. Look at this, what is going on? How can people's mystical or religious experiences be anything, you know, be evidence of anything? Clearly, people who have these experiences for the most part are delusional. You know, they've got caught up in wishful thinking. Oh, what have you? I thought this was a very bad philosophical argument until I started studying it. And then I discovered that it's a little different and that actually it's impressive. And I don't know if it works. I don't know if any philosophical proof works. I don't know. I think there's something
like a real philosopher.
Yeah. I certainly don't think any as a real philosopher, as a real Jew, I certainly don't think any of the proofs against the existence of God work. That's for sure. But I felt a lot of force when I read more about this argument from religious experience. It struck me, and I felt a lot of force in the argument. One of the books actually that played a role in kind of converting me. I shouldn't, given what I said, I shouldn't use that word too strongly, and convincing me that this is a powerful argument, right? So far as philosophical arguments go. One of the books that really changed my mind about the value of the argument was from an Orthodox Jew, Yehuda Gelman.
Got it right here.
Jerome Gelman wrote a book on religious experience. It's got the title's a bit of a mouthful. It's Religious Experience and the Rationality of Theistic Belief. It's a long title, yeah. But it's a little, I think it would be a little maybe a little too technical for listeners who haven't studied much philosophy. I think that many could get the main point. And when I read Yehuda Gelman's excellent book on religious experience, I think most listeners with some patience would get the main point. And I should recommend his book. He's just an excellent philosopher of religion, and a lot to me and many other people working in Jewish philosophy. When I read this book on religious experience of his, I put it down and thought, wow, my mind has changed. There's something here, right? And to present it more fully for your listeners, it goes really. This isn't Gelman. It's simplified. Something like this. Start off with a principle about seeing, a principle about appearances, a principle about perception, if you will. Okay, things are. Likely things are as they seem to be. Okay. Things are likely the way they appear to be. Seeing is believing, as they say. This is a principle about trusting appearances, and we do all the time. Okay. Why do you think that there's a computer in front of you right now, or a book in front of you right now, or that you're in a room or outside or doing whatever it is the listener is doing? Why do you think this? Well, it looks that way to you, right? And you trust the way things look. Why do you think that there's an apple there, or that there's a tree there, or that your spouse is talking to you, or that whatever it is in your environment? Why do you believe these things? Because it looks that way. It seems to you that way. And if this kind of principle weren't true, if things were not likely the way they seem to be, it would be very hard to see how you could reasonably believe in anything that you do believe. Pretty much anything about your surroundings, anything about the objects you encounter, experience, or perceive. So as a matter of fact, you rely on this kind of principle, seeing is believing, things are likely the way they appear to be, all the time. And it's hard to see how you could believe very much about the world reasonably without such a principle, connecting appearances to belief. Okay. Other things being equal, we need to add a qualification. Of course, if you've just ingested LSD, okay, then perhaps you shouldn't trust the appearance of the pink elephant in the room.
Right, but then you have a defeat, therefore. You have a reason not to trust it.
Exactly. So we can add bells and whistles to make this principle more plausible. Okay. Things are likely the way they appear to be, or you should believe that things are the way they seem, other things being equal, unless you have some reason not to. Okay. Like you've just ingested LSD. And we could think of a lot of reasons not to.
Right. Or you met John, but really you met Jackie's twin, but you thought you met John.
Oh, right.
When you get introduced to the idea that he has a twin, you realize, oh, there's a different
guy. That's more complicated. That's a more complicated problem. Right. Okay. Yes. If it seems to you that you're meeting twin one, okay. Maybe, you know, given how close twin one looks to twin two, maybe in this case you shouldn't trust appearances and say, oh, I'm meeting twin one. Once you know that there's somebody who looks just like this, you should sort of be more cautious. You should, well, it could be twin one, it could be twin two. Okay, that's a more complicated case. But the general moral is that you should trust the way things, and you do.
Right.
Trust the way things seem, special considerations aside. Okay, that's our principle. And here's our next premise. It seems to a lot of people that they're in the presence of God. It seems to a lot of people that God is forgiving them or judging them or doing this to them. The experiences can be more or less robust or detailed. Some people just have a kind of lingering sort of religious feeling, you know, that's of God's presence in the life or at the moment. Some people have visions, right? Very detailed, robust kinds of mystical experiences. There's a whole range of experiences here that people have. Millions of people to some have experiences like this. Millions of people across time, across cultures. And these are, it seems to these people to be the case that God exists. So from the principle that we should trust what seems to be the case, and the evidence that it seems to be the case that to many of people that God exists, they have experiences, appearances of, it seems to them that God is present or forgiving them, or, you know, they see an angel or what. We should conclude that probably, likely, God is present. God is forgiving them or what have you. And likely then that God exists. Now there is of course the problem.
Can I push back?
The qualification that we added to that principle is going to be quite important, right? Remember the original principle, you should trust the way things seem to you. If something seems to be the case, it probably is the case. Special considerations and exceptions aside, if you've ingested LSD, you shouldn't trust appearances. And we're going to have to account for that in this case, because we're going to have to wonder, are these religious experiences such special cases? And so far as the proponents of the argument go, they say, no, look, people who are having these experiences, they haven't typically, well, some of them maybe, but they haven't typically ingested LSD. Okay. And the other kinds of worries we might have about that would lead us to withhold our assent, which would undermine our trust in appearances, in our experiences, also don't apply in this case.
So here's a question, though. Okay, there is more content to people's religious experiences, right? And often these religious experiences contradict, right? Where Muhammad, the prophet, receives the messages from the angel, the messages attributed to the Bible are contradicted, and his revelation overrides that revelation. And of course, individual believers, I saw once a video of a Muslim girl who was born Christian, and then like she heard a voice in her head that said, I'm Allah, right? I don't know how she reconciles that, but Islam, being Muhammad being the last prophet, I guess he's the last prophet, but still, you know, she says, you know, the her Christian faith was refuted by a religious experience. So we have these contradictory religious experiences, and how can we then derive from these contradictory religious experiences that there is a God if it's not the same God that you derive from it?
Excellent objection. Right. So there are diverse religious experiences. Sometimes when people seem to see things and they disagree a lot about what they're seeing or claim to be seeing, we are a little skeptical. You know, if you say that you're seeing a pink elephant in the corner, and I say, what, you know, there's a table in the corner, and twin one comes into the room and says, what are you talking about? There's a unicorn in the corner. And twin two comes into the room and says, there's nothing in the corner. What's that? I think that we'd scratch our heads and say something's gone wrong. We should not trust our experiences. You know, there must be some sort of illusion we're subject to or something else. When there's wide scale disagreements, we pull back. The kinds of experience, there's something unreliable here. You might think that this is the case in with religious experiences. There's widespread disagreement between divergences between religious experiences. And so we should hold back. You know, we should be skeptical of these experiences. There's much to be said for this objection and against it. So one thing to note is that while many people have diverse religious experiences, the experiences aren't obviously inconsistent. They aren't obviously incompatible. You use the word contradictory. If I claim that there's a pink elephant in the corner of the room and you claim, no, there's a table in the corner of the room, there's a real tension in our claims here. One of us is misreporting things, or getting things wrong, hallucinating, what have you. But
I happen to be colorblind.
Oh.
See, I think that plays into this.
Okay. Sorry about the examples then.
No, I'm saying like, I might see a pink elephant and you see a red elephant.
Okay. Well, but a lot of religious experiences that do diverge aren't quite like that, right? You might have some people experiencing God as just, say, or as, you know, pulling on their conscience, they've done something wrong. You might have other people experiencing God as merciful. Okay, they might have a sense of God's forgiving them or something like that. I might see an angel that says to them, God has now forgiven you, son. Okay, so if it's a very vivid mystical experience, they might even have that sort of visual and auditory imagery. Though usually religious experiences aren't quite as vivid.
My grandmother, I'm of course a convert to Judaism, my grandmother, my father's side, sat on a deathbed that she saw the Virgin Mary standing.
Okay.
Happens to be Catholic.
That is very, that would be a very vivid kind of religious experience. Such experiences are more or less rare. But anyhow, it's not really contradictory or inconsistent for people to have these experiences. Well, it could be the case. It's perfectly possible that God is angry with this individual and is forgiving that individual. It's perfectly possible that God is both just and merciful, right? And that one person could be seeing this feature of God in this way, and another person could be seeing that feature of God in that way. So the diversity of religious experiences doesn't necessarily mean that these aren't genuine experiences of the same being, because the same kind of being can present in different ways to different people based on the people's circumstances and their possessions. This is even true for physical objects, right? You see an event from one angle, another person sees an event from another angle, your descriptions are going to be quite different. But there needn't be anything contradictory, okay? The audience can understand, oh, yeah, you're reporting this part of the event, he's reporting that part of the event. They're reporting the same event, they just saw it differently. Their reports are contradictory. And similarly, you might think in the case of many divergent religious experiences, this is what's happening. Now, that isn't always the case. Sometimes, really, people have experiences of God that are in deep tension. You might experience God as a perfect unity in some way and somebody else as a trinity. And let's say not as a perfect unity. Okay.
Maybe that's Vishnu.
All right. You might experience the God of the Hebrew Bible and somebody else might experience, you know, some sort of polytheistic or claim to experience a number of these deities at once visiting them. And there's no ways that the God of the Hebrew Bible and these deities could both exist, because
the God of the Hebrew Bible is not going to pretend to be polytheistic beings.
Right. Probably not.
Based on his published works.
Based on his published work, my question, maybe God could, you know, appear to people in very different guises. Maybe God could appear to one person in a Hinduish guise to another as a Jewish guise and to another as a Muslim guy in a Muslim, maybe. But I'd like to set up a case where this is implausible. Still, I think there's much to be, you know, that we can answer this. Here's one thing you might say. One thing you might say is that in these cases where there's a real tension, maybe what's happening, this is a hypothesis, okay? We shouldn't reject the experience wholesale. What's happening is that we have two people who are having experiences of God, but these experiences, how they interpret them, what they take themselves to be seeing, is filtered through their religious understanding and education, okay, their worldview in general. And this often enough happens when it comes to ordinary experiences, right? The way a Democrat sees a certain political event and the way a Republican sees that political event, the way they describe it can be radically different.
Very right? different. They can see the same video and radical different interpretations of it.
See this today. See the debates. And there's so much political polarization today in the U.S. You have people on the far left, on the far right, watch the same video, seen the same events, and they just have totally different descriptions of what's going on. They take it to very different meanings.
Right, and just because they have a different interpretation doesn't mean the event didn't happen.
Right, exactly. So there might be a common core to these, to the experience, and something that they're both witnessing that's just being filtered through their political prejudices or their education or their or the way they see things. And so it looks very different to them, and their descriptions and reports of it are going to be different. Maybe that can happen in religious experiences too. Okay. Should we give a, would you, I mean, if you saw a debate between a Democrat and a Republican or somebody on the very far right and the very far left about some event, would it be reasonable to say that the event didn't happen at all?
No.
No. So maybe similarly here, when it comes to very divergent religious experiences, we should do the same. Maybe we should say that there's something going on. And there will be something there will be some crossover between their descriptions. They're both descriptions supposedly of a God, of a supernatural being, of immense power and so on. And maybe we should say that where they disagree, we should think that this is a matter of their religious education or tradition influencing what they see.
Right, their assumptions.
There are other ways we could deal with this problem. You know, sometimes people disagree so radically about something, but they're a minority, right? You might have thousands of people who witness some sort of historical event, a war, okay, what have you, you know, Second World War. Lots of books on the Second World War. Well, you might find some contradictions, and you might find a few individuals who say nutty things about the Second World War. But should we reject this testimony about the Second World War, not take as genuine people's experiences of the Second World War, just because a few rare individuals have some nutty things to say, experienced events in very different way? I don't think so. I think what we would do is just put those strange cases aside.
And right. I think you could get so far, I think the argument works at least in the sense that you can't just dismiss religious experiences out of hand. And they're common enough to say there's a pattern going on here.
Millions of people have these experiences. The experiences to these people are quite, in many respects, very similar. Their experiences of a supernatural reality, of its power, of its being in some sort of, having some sort of moral character, what have you. These are very, very similar in many ways. Now, of course, there are differences too. People in the West might experience this being as personal, as a kind of agent or something like that. Whereas people in the East might experience it as a more impersonal kind of being.
energy, like some experience of energy is the wrong word.
Eastern religions understand God in a very impersonal, abstract way.
Right. Okay.
Of course, there are people in Western religions who do that too. But there's often a difference here. People in certain versions, popular versions of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, have a very personal picture of God as a kind of intelligent agent, something like you and me. And it's, you know, when they come into contact with reality, with God, they might interpret it in this way. And somebody who comes from an Eastern tradition that has some sort of version of Hinduism that takes God to be an impersonal kind of being might understand the experiences in that sort of way. Still, there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of...
Sounds like John Hicks. You ever read John Hicks?
Common core to their experience that maybe we should take seriously.
I hear.
There will be fringe cases, weird cases where people, you know, where we can't accommodate it in this way. There are always weird cases, you know, about when millions of people observe and report something, they report differences. Some people might, you know, we might want to just dismiss or put aside certain specific reports that don't gel with the majority.
And, right.
And not reject the reality of what's being reported just because a few people have very radical and radically different experiences. So too, when it comes to religious experiences, there's commonality between these, there's diversity between these. We might invoke similar strategies to explain away the diversity to make it unproblematic.
Right, I hear. But that leads you to maybe some supernatural, right? But it doesn't necessarily then lead you to a theistic God, right? Mm. That the argument doesn't bring you to the God of Abraham or something like
that. This is a standard...
Something maybe compatible with the God of Abraham.
This is a standard objection against many of the philosophical arguments for the existence of God. Many, many critics will say that, look, the cosmological argument, even if it works, even if this argument proves that there is a first cause, a necessary being that brought about a universe, it doesn't show that this being is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. Right. Even if the argument shows that there's an intelligent designer of natural laws, or they're fine-tuning, or organ, it doesn't show that this being is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. This is a stock objection against...
It's a classic. It was tossed against Aquinas.
Yeah. Hume makes a lot of this objection, right? Mm. There are a lot of responses that religious believers make in turn.
Some of them are very good.
If the universe has a first cause, the first cause of the universe must be impressive in just this, that way. Or it's simpler to think of this being infinite than finite, or. There's a lot of responses to this objection, subsequent objections, and so on. But you're right, this also arises, this classical objection also arises for this argument from religious experience. Maybe the common core that we should be focusing on is very thin. Maybe these experiences, so far as they go, just show that there's some supernatural reality that we're in touch with, and that, you know, our religious upbringing interprets as an experience of God, interprets as God in the Islamic way, or in the Jewish way, or in the Hindu way, or what have you. But really, the common core to all these experiences, what we should be taking seriously, is pretty thin. There's a supernatural being that's pretty immense. Okay. Has some moral character. Not God. Well, one thing to say to that is, and in respect of all these arguments, it would be pretty quite an accomplishment to prove that there is a first cause that is at all like God. Or a design.
No, for sure. That are materialists have to deal with that.
These are not uninteresting philosophical conclusions.
Right. I probably do some podcast on that at some point, but on Dale's topic. I have a quick question. I have a problem with this argument, and I think one of the big problems in it, this is for many people, like I don't have religious experiences in that sense. Maybe I have some spiritual moments, but one of the big issues I have, I think it's culturally, I just the way also I think and the way I operate, it just feels so arbitrary, right? Like these subjective personal encounters. But I think, I don't know, like I think that has a lot more to do with my cultural upbringing and the way of thinking than as an objection to the argument. I have to sit on this because intuitively, right, it doesn't feel plausible, but that is just maybe me. Go ahead.
Yeah, maybe I was also brought up with the same. I didn't go to any sort of, there are certain churches, for example, and you see them on TV services of these where these are pretty, you know, people seem to be experiencing something. They like, they, and there are certain, you have, you know, you have these mystics in religious traditions. I certainly wasn't brought up in a synagogue or in circumstances where I witnessed people, you know, falling to the ground and crying and claiming they saw God or having mystical experiences. Maybe that just makes me think that these are strange in people reporting.
Right.
We must remember though that the argument from religious experience isn't really about or needn't only be about people who seem to be strange to us, right? Strange people in these strange churches.
Right. I have met serious strange, intellectuals who had strange, religious experiences.
Strange individuals. No. We're talking about experiences had by millions of ordinary believers where they haven't been hopped up in some sort of weird environment, and it's just seemed to them that God is present. Or that, right. Or experiences had by extremely intelligent and otherwise, you know, extremely people with who have a lot of honesty and integrity, and we know this otherwise, right? Who have experiences of God, and
right.
Sometimes very brilliant people have very robust and detailed experiences of God in the Jewish tradition. Okay. Now, there are of course prophets, right? This is a very high level religious experience. This is a thing on its own to be spoken about, you know, Isaiah and Elijah. Okay, these are religious experiences of a certain kind, but even subsequently in the tradition, there are people who are closer to us in time, in culture, and so on, who we have their books. We know they're especially acute thinkers, you know, rabbinic scholars, Talmudists who are known for their legal works and so on, the Mechaber, Yosef Karo, the Vilna Gaon, and others. And they have very detailed religious experiences where they see visions or hear voices or have books dictated to them. These aren't stupid people. They're not bad people. They're extremely intelligent. We know they're extremely pious, and they're telling about encounters with angels and voices they're hearing and so on. Well,
yeah, but for me, that's like the other way around.
Maybe we should take it seriously.
Right? I hear, but for me, it's the other way. Like, I don't know, Yosef Karo writes about that he had an angel visiting him. And I always say, like, it's not that we believe Yosef Karo because he visits an angel. We believe Yosef Karo because he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, right? Like,
But the author of the Shulchan Aruch is a very intelligent, okay, is it no fool? And he's an acute intellect, and he's a kind of person I would trust with my kids. Okay, this is integrity, right? So one's got the prima facie that when he says that he experiences these things, probably not making it up. Could he have been fooled? Was he mentally unstable, delusional? These are hard things to swallow.
Right. That's a very good point. I mean, I think instinctively, you don't have an obligation to believe this, this, that. But like, he wrote it down, so you can't just dismiss it out of hand.
Not only him, right?
The Ramchal.
Yeah, the Ramchal's letters are astonishing in the details and of his visions, and the Vilna Gaon's visions, and the Baal Shem Tov, and many, many Jewish scholars and mystics have experiences like this. Should we be dismissing them all as delusional or as liars or something? Maybe. I mean, that's
far-fetched.
Yeah. So what best makes sense of these reports? Here's another way we could, what is the best way to make sense of these reports? Maybe it's they really were in touch with another reality, and they're just the sort of people who would be, right? They're just the sort of people who this other reality would reveal itself to.
Right.
If right. It,
yeah. I have to think about it because, like I said, normally I just like kind of brush away those kind of stories, but you can't just brush it away. But just because you don't have an obligation to believe them doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Right. I don't know what to make of this as a proof of the existence of God, an argument for the existence of God. I need to think about it more, but it's sure intriguing. And I do feel that there's some power in it. Maybe it is some evidence for the existence of God. I wouldn't base all my religious belief on it. I think there are Jewish arguments for the existence of God and so on that have more force. It's an argument that has intrigued me, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to think through it more with you now, because I haven't given it as much thought as I would have liked in the past.
I didn't finish Gelman's book. I never finished it because I had such an issue with the basic idea, because it sounds so subjective. I mean, he deals with it, but I'm going to give it another look, because like, I can't just because my culture is skeptical doesn't mean I have to be, right?
Maybe I've suffered you up to it.
I did read Swinburne under. Oh, anyway. Well, I think we're getting to an end. We should pick up some other topic another time.
Well, I'm sure your listeners who have had the patience to follow me at all, many of them must have a lot of objections of their own and questions and thoughts. I don't mean to present this as the last word. There's many more problems with the argument. There's much more to be said about it. But I hope it's a starting point and something that they can have for, a moment's thought that's entertaining or maybe even religiously significant to them. Maybe like you, they'd be interested to pursue it further.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely pursue it further because, it's all these things are always interesting to me. Okay. Really running into an end of the podcast. I really want to get you back at some point. Maybe we do it again.
Sure.
Maybe we talk about something else than arguments for God,
Yeah, we can talk about a particular Jewish topic maybe, or some sort of philosophical puzzle about Judaism or within the Jewish tradition that a lot of Jewish writers have written. Maybe something non-religious, something else philosophical. I'm here and I had fun chatting with you about this now, and would be delighted to speak to you and your listeners again in the future.
That would be great. Okay, thank you very much. This is Tyrone, I was gonna say Gelman, but Tyrone Goldsmith.
Maybe when I grow up one day.
Right, well, you never know. Maybe your next book on ontological argument or Hume really is gonna just boost you up to fame, and then I get some clicks just for having you on. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you to the audience, and I will be back with some other podcast at some point. I'm really chaotic about this. I have to get into Seder. I got to get organized about it, and then we'll move on.